starts in a couple of weeks, but many teenagers aren't sure if they should return to class. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, why a new survey says teens are anxious about going back to brick and mortar school. Give us a call with your thoughts. It's 549-2937. Then later, how you can claim money you might be owed by the state. But first this hour, here's the latest on the COVID crisis by the numbers. Statewide, we are at nearly 492,000 cases and 7,157 deaths. A quick note, most of the state-run testing sites had been closed since Thursday because of the storm that passed us by. And since test results take a few days to process, we don't know yet if Monday's lower total was affected by the state storm operations. In our area, the death toll has ticked up again. It stands at 271 from coronavirus. Now, given these numbers, it's no surprise teens are anxious about going back to brick and mortar school right now. A new survey from Junior Achievement by research firm Engine Insights shows that two-thirds of America's teens are concerned about attending school in person this fall, and they report by nearly 3 in 4 margin that their parents or caregivers are concerned too. The survey drops as Duval County Public Schools got approval this week for its back-to-school hybrid plan approved by the state. Now we are about 2 weeks out from the first day of school in Jacksonville. Nearly one-third of students enrolled in the Duval County Public Schools have let the administrators know that they plan to attend virtually. Let's talk about this. We're pleased to welcome Teresa Smith, Vice President of Programs for Junior Achievement of North Florida. Hey, Teresa.
Good morning. How are you today?
Good to have you. Ariana Cobb is with us. She's a 10th grader at Stanton College Prep. Hi, Ariana.
Hi.
And another student is with us. It's Xavier Yancey. He is a student at the Jean Ribault Early College Program. Xavier, good to have you.
Hello.
And Ariana, give us a call back. I think we accidentally disconnected you. And we're already getting calls about this as we talk about the back-to-school survey from Junior Achievement. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. Teresa, let's start with you. It's not a surprise to see these numbers, but it shows you how much anxiety there is out there. Your achievement finds right. Two-thirds of America's teens are worried about going back to school.
Yes, yes. And it's no wonder why. I mean, with so much going on and now continuing to see that the cases, they have not been depleted, I totally understand the students' fear and their uncertainty when it comes back to going to school. And we could just think about the fact that when they're in school, it's now I'm having the pressures of not only learning the materials, but now I have a fear about whether I'm going to get sick or if I could possibly get my parents or caretakers sick. And so that's just a lot to battle all at once. It's already so many pressures of being a youth growing up in these times and trying to figure out myself and going through puberty and just everything. It just adds another layer of worry to the students during these uncertain times.
It really does. Let's talk to the students now. Xavier, you are a student at Jean Ribault High in their early college program. What is your plan for returning to school? Will you go back to the school or will you learn virtually?
My plan is to return to campus as we speak, just to be safe, stay 6 feet away from each other, and plan to wear a mask.
Right. And so do you have any anxiety about that, or how are you feeling about that?
I'm feeling as if the district has a way for students to learn safe while returning to school, then I'm all for it, as long as we have a plan.
How do you feel about the Duval County Schools plan? It's a hybrid plan, so you'll start by only going back 2 days a week, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
And how do you feel about that?
I feel as if it's a process. Rome wasn't built in a day. You can't just jump start back in the school system and expect everything to be fine.
I think that's absolutely right. Let's talk now to Ariana Cobb. She is a rising 10th grader at Stanton College Prep. Ariana, we heard from Xavier. What are your plans for going back to Stanton?
I plan on attending campus again with the hybrid schedule.
And how are you feeling about that?
I'm definitely concerned with COVID-19 because it's a matter of thinking about whether, to what extent you're willing to risk your education, because going back to hybrid, there is still a risk that you may get it, but you also have to put trust in the district that they have a plan to make sure that you don't.
And how are your parents feeling about you going back to campus?
My mom, she's a nurse at the Children's Hospital, and she's been going to work since the COVID outbreak just to help others. And even though there's a risk, she's been continuing to go to work. So I think my mom's more pro going back to school with the hybrid plan.
I see. And let me ask you both about this as well. The Junior Achievement Survey also found that despite the anxiety America's teens are feeling, most of them also said the quality of their online classes from the spring was fair or poor. Virtual learning is just no substitute for in-person learning. Xavier, is that part of what's driving your decision to go back to class?
Yes, ma'am. I feel as if virtual learning, different people learn different ways. Some people love it. Some people hate it. Me, personally, I feel as if I have to be in a classroom to focus.
You know what, Xavier? My two daughters certainly felt that way. They want to go back to actual physical school. Ariana, what about you? What was your virtual learning experience like?
It was definitely lower than I expected when it came to the coursework and how we were able to communicate with our teachers. So I feel like I better understood what we were learning in school versus on the homeroom.
And Teresa Smith on the line now for Junior Achievement of North Florida. This shows you the conflicting anxieties teens have. On the one hand,
yes,
they're nervous about going back, but they also feel, most of them, that it's simply a better educational experience. As we're learning in Duval County, one-third of teens are opting for virtual learning in August. The rest say they'll go back to school for the hybrid plan.
Right, right, most definitely. And, you know, to the point, students learn a variety of ways. And there are some cases, just for students, they need to have that face-to-face or interaction when it comes to learning things in the classroom, because there are just things that you just can't get virtually. However, they just want to ensure, though, as you're bringing me back to campus, that we're doing it safely. And so let's ensure that we do have a clear-cut plan so I can continue to learn, but learn safely as well.
And would you be hopeful that the district might tweak its plan, given that we're seeing outbreaks of COVID in other schools, particularly up in Georgia? That's been widely reported. On the very first day of class up there in Georgia's most populated county, they saw an outbreak.
Right, yes. And I do feel confident that Duval County Public Schools, they will adapt their plan. I think right now it's just we're starting with this to see what the next steps are going to be. But I do definitely think as they move along, they're going to reassess. That's one thing that I'm so proud of when it comes to the students, as well as the school board and the school system in general, the flexibility. I've learned I cannot plan for tomorrow. It needs to be a moment by moment, because things can change in the blink of an eye. And I feel that Duval County Public Schools, they are prepared to be able to switch things if it happens, whatever happens, to be able to switch so if they can ensure not just the safety of their students, but also the faculty and staff.
Yeah,
that is also key.
Let's give kudos to the school faculty and staff, the superintendents who had to roll out a virtual plan at a moment's notice in the spring,
right,
and are now,
yes,
having to plan in this uncertain situation right now. It's tough for them, and we want to thank them for their flexibility. Let's go to some calls now as we speak with two local high school students and Teresa Smith of Junior Achievement North Florida. Looking at a new national survey showing just how much anxiety the nation's teens have about returning to school, what are your thoughts? Do you have kids going back to school? Give us a call. 549-2937. Denise is in Ponte Vedra. Hi, Denise. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I actually have four. I have all four are half custody. I've got two in public school and two in private school. And one in private school is going to do virtual because he suffers diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
He's very self-motivated, so that's a really great decision for us. The second one in public school is self-motivated, and she will do fine doing virtual school through St. Johns County. And then two at Episcopal will be going to campus. A bigger concern for everyone we know is many parents are out of jobs. As we know, many children have had to step up to the table to help provide for the home, and schools, both public and private, are not only providing food, but social interaction. And our bigger problem we've got in all of America right now is not COVID. This is suicide and depression. And right now we need to think of every single person we know in high school that is not top social interaction, that possibly could have been in their home alone more than we've known and thought about for 6 months. And so this is a way bigger problem than teachers can handle. And whether the child is virtual or at school, each child needs to be cared for and loved for. And whether that's 10 feet away in a driveway outside, that child needs to be heard and spoken to and talked to, and let that child know and the parents know that are suffering major depression and suicide, because that is up way more than COVID, that we as a community need to be there for each other.
Thanks, Denise.
And listen and love on each other. And we need to provide food and really ears right now.
I agree, Denise. Thank you. And Denise, I want to thank you for being such a good mom to four kids. Wow. I salute you with, it sounds like you're on top of everything. And she's right. You know, Xavier, kids were suffering at higher rates anyway from depression and anxiety disorders and suicide. And it's just been such a sad situation for your generation having to deal with this. What do you and your peers, when you talk about these issues, what do you say to each other?
No.
Hey, go ahead, Xavier.
Okay, well, with me and my friends, we know that this is a life-threatening situation. We can't go back to our homes and spread it to our parents. So we mainly follow guidelines and protocols throughout the day. We don't touch. We don't do none of that. But we have conversations, though. We mainly FaceTime during these tough times, or we get on the game. Just staying connected any way we can virtually.
Right. Staying connected is so important for all of us. Ariana, you know, teenagers had enough pressure, as the caller pointed out, before this pandemic even came along. How are you and your peers dealing with all of these issues, anxiety and depression?
I think mostly we're just trying to stay in touch and make sure that everyone isn't suffering from those things. We often have group FaceTimes, or we might do Zoom calls, because our school has been very involved with making sure that we all stay in touch through the pandemic.
And Teresa Smith, Junior Achievement, when you look further into your survey results, it really breaks my heart. This is what teens say they're worried about. In addition to the immediate concern about the pandemic, they're very worried about the future. They're worried that they won't be able to get a good job that pays a living wage. They're worried about their parents not being able to provide for them. They're worried that they're going to have to borrow too much for college. These are just some of the worries floating through the heads of our young people right now.
Yes, that is. And that they're valid worries as well. And that's why with Junior Achievement, we are here to offer supplemental programming, whether they're in person, face-to-face, or even virtually, but these programs are given to the students so they can continue to hope and dream about tomorrow. Our programs teach the students about work readiness, about entrepreneurship, as well as financial literacy. And I break it down so we tell you the importance of not just of what the job is details, but how to keep the job, how it can apply to you. So we apply these programs and provide these programs to students so they can really understand how they can use their math and science and reading that they're learning in school, but in the real world. For schools right now, science, math, history, all of those things are being taught, but no one's really teaching me about those work readiness things, how I can not only get a job, but keep it, how I can really apply that to budgeting and learning about credit so they can make wise decisions. We've even altered some of our programs to even just address times like these. So when it comes to even saving during this pandemic, what are things that you can do now How can we continue to show how you can adapt even in times like these? And that's what our programs are able to offer to students. And that's from kindergarten through 12th grade that we have these programs available.
Yes, and it's Junior Achievement North Florida, JANFL.org. As we talk with Junior Achievement and two local high schoolers about their anxieties about returning to school, what are your questions, thoughts? It's 549-2937. Jay is in Arlington. Hi, Jay. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just thinking that even just on what the previous commenter was speaking about readiness, I think the other side of the spectrum is not being taken into consideration in regards to the parents having the opportunity now to be able to equip their students, their teenagers, with some of the skills that the school does not provide, as well as making sure they're educated, but also things like what they're speaking of. A lot of parents have experience on jobs and through organizations that they can now spend more time showing their students, showing their teens, here's what the job market is going to be like. Here's what the world is going to be like. Let me make sure you're prepared. I think by default, a lot of times parents defer that to teachers and to the school system. Mm-hmm. And I think then the responsibility now has come back to the parents to say, hey, I need to make sure my child is ready for the world when they get out there because it's coming. And now I have the time and more time to spend with them. I do agree that the teens are missing the social interactions. I have one that just graduated in 2020, one that is going to be a junior this year, and then I also have a seventh grader coming up, and they definitely miss the social interaction, but I think a lot of that has to be mitigated with, you know, a family time or finding other ways to get out to socialize with their peers. But I think, you know, a lot of people are missing the other side of the spectrum where parents become more responsible for making sure that individual is prepared.
And I appreciate all that, Jay. Thank you for that. Here is a comment when it comes to virtual learning that I want to ask Xavier about on our Facebook page. Siobhan writes, I wonder how their digital learning experience unfolded in the spring. What did they need more and less of during distance learning? Xavier, you and Ariana, all the high schoolers, will still be doing distance learning a few days a week, at least in the beginning of school. What do you think could make the experience better?
To me, I think what can make the experience better is that someone has to come up with an idea to make it interactive and fun. If they don't have a plan to make it interactive and fun, then students won't mainly be solely focused on learning. They'll be focused on finding a way to bridge the gap that we've been having for the past 6 months. We haven't been experiencing no interactions for almost half a year, so you can't expect the student to sit in a classroom with his peers and not talk.
Yeah, and I'm sure your peers and kids across the city feel that way, Ariana. Kids are going to be very excited to see each other, and it will be a challenge to get everyone to follow CDC guidelines. We have a tweet here from John. My concern as an educator is making sure administrators support the school's efforts to ensure compliance with CDC guidelines. Otherwise, any safety policy will be toothless, and learning will be disrupted by the bad behavior of a few. In other words, you know, kids at the high school level will, you know, you would think would be better able to follow the rules than elementary school kids. Do you think your peers will do that? Will they all wear masks and socially distance as best anyway as they're able to in classrooms?
I think I'm almost positive that my peers and my classmates know the seriousness of how COVID has affected people and how that you can get COVID and it's a very serious matter. So I'm pretty confident that we'll be able to follow the guidelines just because we understand how it can affect us if we don't.
Another tweet from a listener. My kiddo is suffering from anxiety and grief. Anxiety at the prospects of life in an uncontrolled deadly pandemic and grief at what she is losing. I get angry every day because it did not have to be like this, she says. And Teresa, you know, I think that's a pretty fair assessment of how most parents out there are feeling about this.
That is so true. It is. And it's a constant just reminder of the things that we are lacking in. And that's why it's just so important when it comes to our programs that we are creating things that are hands-on. So the students are still able to participate in things like a job shadow and create products at home so they can feel as if they're a part. And that's something that we are dedicated at Junior Achievement of North Florida to doing. And also to provide families resources so they can also be able to go through these times of uncertainty. So we're doing things like family finance and fun days as well so they can come together as a family, but also just to equip them with other ideas on how you are able to bring your child, your children, and teach these important skills that aren't taught in school, but also to prepare them about furthering their education or just when it comes to a career, personal development, and most importantly, too, I believe, is that self-confidence and belief in self. We want them to really understand that, but again, we have to equip not just the students, but the families as well that's going through this during these times.
That's right. Let's take one more call. It's Donna in Jacksonville Beach. Hi, Donna.
Hi there.
Go ahead.
I was just calling because I am a middle school science teacher, and
okay.
I hear the students saying we need more interaction, we need to have an interactive curriculum, and I was setting up my classroom yesterday, and I'm just really overwhelmed with the thoughts, like, how do I provide an interactive curriculum virtually? How do I provide an interactive curriculum in my classroom? I'm a very hands-on teacher. We use microscopes, we use goggles, we do labs, but I really feel like that will be an impossible task this year.
Donna, you are so right. And that extends to so many different classes. And I'm so sorry that you have to try to figure out this challenge. It's just not fair. And thank you for...
And for the kids, I just wanted to throw that out there for educators, and I miss my students. And
I know you do.
All of us.
and thank you for all you do. This is so tough for teachers and so tough for parents and so tough for the kids. It's tough on all of us. Xavier, we'll close with you. Are you still, despite all of this, excited to go back to school?
Yes, ma'am.
What are you most excited about?
Seeing brand new faces, seeing some old faces. I want to see how this all plays out. I want to see if they... Because this is the first time that I have actually get to witness a pandemic like this. I want to see if we can actually get through it. It shows the unity of our country and advancements in technology.
Well, Xavier, I want to thank you. Xavier Yancey is a student at Rebalt. He's in their early college program. Ariana Cobb, a rising 10th grader at Stanton. And Teresa Smith, VP of Programs at Junior Achievement North Florida. Thanks so much, everybody.
Thank you for having us. Truly appreciate it.
Thanks, everyone. Much more still ahead. In a few moments, we're going to take a look at the hottest races on your August primary ballot as early voting gets underway. That's in a little bit, but up next.
Especially during this pandemic, where has the local voice and expertise of public health been?
Hugh Green on the state's public health crisis. We'll be right back.
At Vistar, members can think outside the branch. Vistar's internet and mobile banking lets you manage your account from wherever you are. Info at vistarcu.org. Vistar Credit Union. Insured by NCUA.
Electro Lounge can now be heard 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on WJCT 89.9 HD4 Electro Lounge Radio or on the WJCT app. Electro Lounge Radio, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience.
I am the fundraising manager here at the station. The best thing about my job is seeing the notes that come in with all these wonderful donations, talking about how a new story that we did really impacted them. Recently, I've seen a lot of donations come through with comments about us being so fair and balanced. They come to us because we're going to give them the truth. I'm Angel Dublin. This is WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. The pandemic has brought home to all of us the importance of public health. Unfortunately, public health resources have been greatly diminished in this state just when they're needed the most. With thoughts on that, here's our new contributor, Hugh Green.
What has been glaringly apparent to me in the past few months of this pandemic is the diminished role of public health. Before I comment further, let me be clear that I am not in any way disparaging the work of our current county health department or its leadership. They work hard every day, and they're about important work. Yet they operate with a definitive lack of resources. Especially during this pandemic, where has the local voice and expertise of public health been? Let me speak from my past personal experience for a moment. As CEO of a major health system, I experienced the vital role of public health on many occasions, whether it be in programming, in the operation of clinics for the uninsured, or its leadership in times of community crisis. For example, in the midst of hurricanes in the early 2000s, we faced necessary evacuations, including the need to move hospitalized patients to safer locations across our county. The lead role was played by the leadership of the Duval County Department of Health. They coordinated our response and made the best community-wide decisions. Subsequently, that role has been largely diminished. There are two disturbing observations I would make that are even more obvious with the light cast by the coronavirus crisis. First, there has been a significant reduction in resources for public health. Now, let's be clear, these reductions are more broad than just Duval County. They've been drastic across the state. A Florida International University study found that public health funding in Florida was cut more than 35% on a per capita basis over a six-year period. Programs have also been slashed. Children's Medical Services, for example, has largely been dismantled. Locally, in Duval County, public health positions have been cut over 50% in the last decade, from a high of 852 positions to 422 in 2019. Expenditures on public health have been reduced locally by an equivalent percentage. To say the least, all of these cuts are clearly short-sighted. Second, but related, is that public health infrastructure has been dismantled. In the past, there was a decentralized network of local health departments to address local public health issues. Now, with centralization in Tallahassee, county health departments function as state offices in each county, but with dramatically less funding. Even the name has been changed to the Florida Department of Health, Duval County. Expertise and capacity have been reduced in a major way at the local level. These changes have occurred gradually over time and largely unrealized by the public. In the past, the director of the local health department would be a visible member of the mayor's response team. Public health expertise would be brought to bear on our local response to the pandemic. So this is another lesson learned from this current crisis, and one that should not be missed by our state legislators. Restoration of funding of public health should commence now. Restoring the authority and the autonomy of local public health capacity is needed now. I would submit that public health is largely local. Restoring the role of local public health is essential for whatever crisis we face in the future.
Well, early voting got underway Monday for Florida's primary election, which is set for Tuesday, August 18th. There are some interesting local and regional races on the ballot, including races for the Florida House, school board, even a sheriff's race. A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics is tracking them all, and he's on the line now to bring us up to date. A.G., good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How you doing?
Good, thanks. And we do want to let everyone know that early voting is underway. Before we get into the specifics of the races, what are your thoughts about how we're seeing in-person voting versus mail-in or absentee ballots?
Well, you know, what I'm seeing so far is that there's a Democratic push on the early voting stuff. I'm curious to see how it actually plays out when we get to in-person election day, though. I have a feeling the Republicans are going to catch up. I think there is that that motivation there on the Republican side. You've got an active primary for Congressional District 4. You've got the clerk of court race. And we're going to talk about those, but there are reasons for both parties to turn out. I think it's going to even out like it usually does.
Sure. Now, in CD4, incumbent Congressman John Rutherford has a challenger, Eric Aguilar. The winner, which is likely to be Rutherford, will face likely Donna Deegan in the November election.
Right. And, you know, it's tough to see what Aguilar thinks his path to victory is here. You know, Rutherford's a known commodity. He's, you know, this is going to be his third campaign for the seat. He knows the district. He was a former Duval sheriff, et cetera. Aguilar's kind of a wild card, a former Navy officer. He's bought a lot of airtime, but he hasn't really made an impression. This is going to look a lot like the old Andrew Crenshaw races, where Andrew Crenshaw would get a Tea Party challenger and Crenshaw would win something like 70-30 or something like that. I think you're going to see that here. I think Aguilar might be trying to buy name ID for a race down the road, like when Rutherford leaves the Congress or something like that, because this doesn't feel like a winning effort from him.
Okay. In CD5, Congressman Al Lawson faces two challengers, LaShonda Holloway and Albert Chester. There are two Republicans running in this primary, too, Gary Adler and Roger Wagner. That said, as you and I have talked about before, this race is practically a foregone conclusion, too, due to the gerrymandering of these districts and the advantage of the incumbency.
Right. That's in play here. I want to look at the primary on the Democratic side because it's actually interesting for Jacksonville. You've got LaShonda Holloway, who's run before. She ran in 2016. She finished third place there. Albert Chester, former FAMU quarterback, pharmacist, he's in the race. But they're both Jacksonville candidates. So you've got roughly half the district here and half the district every place else. But you've got these two people fighting for, you know, less than half the pie, really. And, you know, Lawson's got relationships here. He's got ties here, too. So this is going to look a lot like a 60%, 70% for Lawson with the other candidates fighting over the rest. You do have a primary there, Adler and Wagoner. History tells us in that seat that the Republicans not going to do that well, even though it's a conservative Democratic seat in terms of the layout of the district is also designed to perform Democratic. So, you know, it's going to take a major effort from either of those two if they get against Lawson in November.
All right. Let's move on and talk about the state representative races for our area in districts 12, 13, 14, and 15. Some are a little more colorful races than others. It's interesting, though, to note some of the contests happening here and also the fact that for the first time in recent memory, the Florida Democratic Party are fielding candidates in every race up and down the ballot. Some will obviously have a much better chance of winning than others. But they're not just writing off these races as foregone conclusions. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, there are two schools of thought on it. The Democrats think that's going to help, you know, turn out ticket across the board. So it'll help Biden. It'll help, you know, other candidates to have, you know, that peg in the state house races. The Republicans think that it'll help their candidates raise more money because, hey, I've got a competitive election, donate. I just don't know where all the donor money comes from for this. So, you know, we'll see what happens here. I don't know if they're going to flip many seats. I think the Democrats do have a chance of making some headway in the Florida Senate, but there's no real Florida Senate competitive race here in the same way. While you do have Travis Hudson has a challenger, that challenger, Heather Hunter, has a lot to overcome to make a serious challenge to him. So we're not going to see much in this area regarding that effort, but it may be that extra percentage point that Biden needs in November driving turnout. So I think that's how people are looking at it.
We're talking Florida primary races with A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics. Okay, let's talk for a minute about the clerk of courts race. On the Republican side, you've got Scott Wilson coming off the city council to run for the Republican nomination for this. So that's opening up a city council seat. There's a race there. If Wilson can fend off the other Republicans in the race, he will face off against Democrat Jimmy Mignette in November. The other two candidates on the Republican side are Leon Jackson and Jody Phillips. There's been a lot going on with this race, AG. What have you been covering?
Yeah, I mean, regarding the clerk of courts race, I mean, Scott Wilson, when he left the city council, he was, you know, he put in his notice to resign while he's still city council president, which was an audacious play to make. But, you know, his reasoning was, well, the seat doesn't come open very often. It's open now. I have a shot at it. Now, the problem is that Jody Phillips, who's actually outraised Wilson in terms of fundraising, you know, has the backing of Daniel Davis, the Jacksonville Chamber, political operatives associated from the Lenny Curry outfit. So you see how the machine works, and you're seeing mail going out against Wilson talking about
Let me jump in because I just got an email from Andy in Neptune Beach, and he wants me to let you know that he says we received a flyer in the mail bringing Scott Wilson to task because he supported Democrat leadership on city council. He goes on to say, has it really come to this, that recognizing the other party renders you unqualified to be clerk of court, which is theoretically a nonpartisan office?
Theoretically, but we know it's not. And, you know, the fact that Phillips' campaign could, you know, put correctly that Wilson did support Tommy Azuri for council president, you know, put correctly that he did make the trip to Atlanta with Musa, Tim Baker, Aaron Zahn, et cetera, you know, all of that is true. But, you know, that stuff was, you know, Wilson, I think, thought that he was being taken in by the machine, but the machine was in fact taking him. And I think his credibility is kneecapped here a bit, and that's what the mailer is pointing to, even though the mailer is put out by the people who, you know, were with Wilson on a lot of these things. That's the irony of it.
Okay, and then how about the fact, too, that the guy leaving the position, Ronnie Fussell, he attracted a fair bit of controversy for pulling courthouse weddings out of the Duval County Courthouse when marriage equality became the law of the land. Do you expect that issue to come up again in this race?
It's coming up. Wilson has actually reached out to some Democrats to try to get them to switch party registrations to vote for him because he has said that he's the only Republican running who would change the courthouse wedding policy, allowing courthouse weddings once again. But in a Republican primary, that may not be a dog that hunts. That's kind of my thought on it. Wilson's trying very hard to expand the voting base, but people aren't going to flip over for the clerk of courts primary. I mean, they did, obviously, when Angela Cory's running against Melissa Nelson, but that was a vastly different operation. And Angela Cory had a reputation that went far beyond, you know, one thing that people disagreed with. It was a systemic thing. And I think you could get some flips there, but even then it was modest, and even then the case for Corey's removal had to be made to Republican voters. I don't know if Wilson has made the case to Republican voters they should be clerk of courts, you know, so much as, well, this is my next job. And to be fair, that's kind of the posture of all the Republicans because Phillips is the aide to Ronnie Fussell and Leon Jackson, the third candidate, also works in the office. So everybody's looking for promotion.
Aren't they all? Yeah, that's the American way, right? Well, as we talk about these races, there's so many more we could get into, but let's focus on a few in the time we have left, beginning with a race for school board. There are a number of school board races on the ballot, but let's talk about the race in Mandarin between former city councilman Matt Schellenberg and current school board member Lori Hershey. Why is that one on your radar?
Well, you know, Hershey, she's been active. I mean, she's been an activist school board member. You know, she tried to make sure that, you know, the school tax referendum was actually something that could work. She butted heads a little bit with Mayor Lenny Curry on it. But Matt Schellenberg is an interesting case in himself because he basically is an anti-Lenny Curry Republican at this point. He said that Curry should resign because of, you know, the JEA scandal. And Schellenberg's got more money right now than Hershey does. And in school board races, that isn't really dispositive in the same way as with other races. A lot of times the less well-funded candidate actually wins a school board race. But, you know, Schellenberg, he's a former city councilman. He's obviously got a reputation over there. It's going to be a tough race. I think both candidates are confident right now. I haven't seen any polling on it, so who knows who's right. But, you know, we'll see if incumbency can overcome money. I think that's the issue here.
And one thing we've learned through the years is that Mandarin voters can be unpredictable. So that will be one to watch. Okay, let's talk Clay County for a minute and the Clay County Sheriff, who has attracted an enormous amount of media attention, none of it flattering. Educate us on who's on the ballot in this race and how you see that one playing out.
Well, I'm going to disagree with your presumption there that none has been flattering, because in fact, Daryl Daniels, the Clay County Sheriff, has gotten a lot of flattering media attention. He's used the office in a way to manufacture media hits. He's got a town hall today, the first day of early voting, on improving relationships with the Sheriff's Department. He put out a video a few weeks ago saying that if protesters came to Clay County for Black Lives Matter Day,
Praise for that among some of his voters. You're right. Yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of television, especially the younger TV reporters, cover his stuff uncritically. This is earned media. And he's running against, it's a six-way race, I believe. You got Michelle Cook, the former Atlantic Beach police chief. She looks like the strongest competition here. But, you know, Daniels is saying that I'm the one that's in Clay County. I'm the one that's here. And the FDLE investigation for false imprisonment of his ex-girlfriend last year for stalking for a brief period, as she was released, of course, you know, that investigation hasn't been resolved. And he said, I think this investigation is political. I don't know why this hasn't moved. Maybe the investigation isn't being done very well, which seemed to be a slam to State Attorney Melissa Nelson, who dragged her feet on it. But when you look at this, it looks like it's Daniel's race to lose. Because the power of incumbency in a six-way race is just too great to overcome. All he's really going to need is about 30%. He's going to get his 30%.
That really, I think, is so emblematic of how so many of these races should be viewed. You know, incumbents simply have the advantage, even if they have a lot of baggage and controversy in their wake. Anything else on the ballot that you want to give folks a quick heads up about before we go to break?
One incumbent that's in trouble in August, maybe, Kim Daniels in House District 14. She's got Angie Nixon up against her. Kim Daniels has a lot of Republican money and backing. If Kim Daniels wins that primary, it's because Republicans helped. And that's one to watch, because Kim Daniels has gotten so much outside criticism, but it looks like Tallahassee Republicans are the cavalry in this case.
Watch that one. And everybody, vote. Early voting is underway now. Election day is Tuesday, August 18th. There are a number of races, including some races for judge, which we did not get into. But educate yourself on the candidates and go and vote. And read up more on our website at wjct.org/elections. And follow AG on Twitter. He is a journalist for Florida Politics and a contributor to this program. Always good to get your insights. Thank you.
Thank you.
And a quick break, but in a moment, how you can find out if you have unclaimed money coming to you from the state of Florida. We'll be right back.
This message is brought to you by the Florida Division of Emergency Management, Florida Public Media, and this radio station.
This is Craig Fugate, the former director of Florida Emergency Management. In this time of COVID, you need to update your hurricane preparedness plan. That means knowing what evacuation zone you live in, and if ordered to leave, you need to go. Take your pets and stay with family or friends, or at an inland hotel. Shelters are another option. Know your zone, know your home. For more information, go to floridastorms.org. That's floridastorms.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Isabel Wilkerson talks about her new book, Cast. It's about the rigid racial hierarchy created in America and why she says it qualifies as a caste system. Wilkerson won a National Book Critics Circle Award for her previous book about the great migration of African Americans from the South to the North. Join us
today at noon here on WJCT News 89.9.
This pandemic is unprecedented, but the way we're hoping to one day mitigate it is a vaccine, which isn't a new idea at all.
For hundreds of years, a vaccine was like, well, let's take a dead piece of the bug and put it inside the body, and the body's immune system will figure out what to do.
I'm Molly Wood. Vaccine technology has come a long way since then. That's next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6, here on WJCT News 89.9.
How do we narrow the gap between what the public expects from the news media and what they think they're getting? Some of the industry's wounds are self-inflicted, but others are the result of attacks from people in power who don't want you to know what they're up to. I'm Jen White. New details from a landmark survey into trust and the media next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, guess what? You could be owed some money from the state of Florida and not even know it. Each year, billions in unclaimed funds get lost in the system. A new app, Claim Found, is trying to help Florida residents find their funds. I spoke about it with app creator Chris Prompovich. Chris, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
And of course, whenever anyone hears the phrase unclaimed cash, their ears prick right up. Tell us about your new company, Claim Found, and how it can help people in Florida perhaps get a hold of some unclaimed funds.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Claim Found, we are a software company with the mission of helping Floridians find and get their money back. Unclaimed money, for those who are unfamiliar, is basically lost money. It could be old utility deposits, life insurance policies from deceased relatives, back taxes, and all of this money ends up with the Florida CFO, and they safeguard it until you come and find it. And traditionally, if you would like to get that money back, you go to the CFO's website and look it up. And what we realized was there was an opportunity to build the next generation software to help people find this money easier and automate the whole process online so you don't have to mail in anything yourself.
To streamline the process, now you got the idea to build this software because you had a friend who had trouble reclaiming money, is that right?
Yeah, that's accurate. Actually, my co-founder, his father went through a process of collecting an unclaimed life insurance policy for my co-founder's deceased grandmother. And it ended up taking him more than a year, and he had to hire an attorney to do it, and he just expressed, a lot of grief going through the process just because it was, very cumbersome and time-consuming. And then that's kind of what spurred our interest in researching the industry, and we realized that no one had built a modern technology solution to deal with this.
So how does Claim Found work if somebody logs onto your site and they want to see if they're eligible for some money?
Yeah, absolutely. So Claim Found works by coming to our website, and on the homepage we have a simple search bar. So as soon as you land on there, you can type your name in and start immediately searching for money in your name. And actually, recently, we have developed what we're calling unclaimed property maps. So we actually plotted the 20 million plus unclaimed property claims in Florida onto an interactive map, and you can zoom into your neighborhood and the places you've worked to locate your money.
And I understand you entered my name. What did you find?
That's right. We actually found 172 claims in your name, totaled at $8,653.
What? That can't all be for me. There've got to be other people named Melissa Ross that have claims, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You do have a relatively common name, so there might be some overlap with other people, but there is a high likelihood that you might have some. And importantly, what we always say to the people who come to our website is, even if you don't have money now, you should still consider signing up because we offer free claim monitoring. So if you ever have money in the future, we'll instantly alert you and notify you of your money. And believe it or not, last year, Florida brought in more than $400 million in new unclaimed money. And across the U.S., there's something like $8 to $9 billion of new money every single year.
That's amazing. And in this time of recession, when people are worried about paying their bills, the demand in this is higher than ever, right?
That's absolutely right. We've just seen traffic to our website has been kind of off the charts over the last couple months, and especially since we launched the maps. Our mission really as a company is to help the financial well-being of Americans and Floridians here to start, and we just want to help the CFO return as much money as possible.
And he's trying to do that. He says the state of Florida is sitting on some $2 billion in unclaimed property. He says one in five Florida residents have unclaimed property of some kind. Why are there so many people wandering around out there who don't know they have property or money that's in their name?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's actually a question we started with when we started the company. What we have boiled down the answer to is there's just a general lack of awareness, for one. Most people just don't know about it, or maybe they've heard about it and are skeptical. We've always heard the expression, there's no such thing as a free lunch, or, you know, watch out for free money. That doesn't exist. And so I think there's some natural skepticism which prevents people from actually realizing that, you know, there really is $2 billion sitting with the state.
So people need to check it out. The website is claimfound.com. Chris, thanks for letting our listeners know all about this. I'm sure they will be checking it out. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Chase that money down, people. Well, that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. She's money, baby. So is Josh Torres. Josh Torres is cringing right now. Our show director, Jessica Palumbo, is our station news director. And Bill Bortsfield runs digital. Keep that feedback coming to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. And catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 or our podcast anytime. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll connect with you again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. In the meantime, have a great day and wear your mask, please.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.